From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. It's been way too long since my guest, writer, director, and actor, Mike White, has been here, but he is now back for his newest adventure, we should call it, Enlightened, the series on HBO that stars Laura Dern and now him. Mike, thanks so much for going back.
Thanks for having me.
The show is so fascinating to me because I think about the way it started with Amy, played by Laura Dern, sobbing in the bathroom. I mean, just almost like a melting clown sobbing in the bathroom, just completely sobbing into camera. And then when the second season starts, she's a completely different person. She's literally a woman with a mission. How much of that did you plan in terms of the writing?
What happened in the first two seasons, the original idea was to do it in one. But then as I started writing, I kept wanting to explore, you know, parts of her world and her life. But the original idea was to have her... a woman who, it's basically becoming a whistleblower and how she tries to make change from within and then gives up on that and then decides she the only way to make positive change is to burn the place down in a sense. So that was kind of the idea. You know, it was always the idea for the first season and it became the first two seasons. So yeah, it's changed a little bit certainly in this season because a lot of the first season is her like trying to find a place to land with all of her good intentions and now... she has, you know, she's a woman with a mission.
I mean, a lot of the comedy comes from the fact that it starts to become this kind of demented version of Silkwood, where she's determined.
Yeah.
And basically, she starts to become somebody because she can't fix her own life. She's got to try to fix the world.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we liked the idea of doing something that was like, yeah, had a Silkwood or, you know, Norma Rae. But, like, at the same time, you know, Amy is, you know, kind of a self-dramatist, you know, in a sense, and that she has slightly delusions of grandeur. You know, it's
slightly?
Like, yes. Well, she has some, yeah. But at the same time, I think there are bad things going on with the company. And so trying to get a sort of something that was ambiguous enough that it didn't feel like it was just that it became too simple a story that, you know, that I do think that like a lot of times it's true. It seems whistleblowers have, there is this sense of, you know, there is a revenge component going on. There's also this sense of, like, wanting to be the hero of some bigger, you know, story. And all of those things I thought would be fun to explore. At the same time, like, at the heart of, you know, her intentions are something that she wants to... she's trying to figure out how the best way to make good. And even though, you know, she's, you know, a little self-deluded, there is a part of her that I think is important, which is her... you know, that I want the audience to be able to connect and you know, often it's in these voiceovers she does where, you know, you go, oh, yeah, okay, what she's talking about or what she wants is something that resonates with me, you know what I mean? And it's fun to me. I've always enjoyed protagonists that, like, you know, you suddenly find yourself siding with them despite the feeling at the beginning that maybe they're very other, there's someone else, you know? And I do think that that's the fun of... fiction, in a sense, is creating compassion for characters that maybe, you know, are harder. You know, it's not always an easy sell, you know?
No, I think that's the interesting thing about it because there are so many shifting loyalties in this show, which is incredible to watch because it happens so often. And Levi, we talking about before, her ex play by Luke Wilson, is one person when we meet him. And in this episode, in the second season, which he goes into treatment, as he was talking about it, I started to ask myself questions whether Amy's version was what really happened or if she just needed to see that. Mm-hmm. I mean, because there's a sequence in that first episode where the undersea wildlife is kind of magical and unreal. And right. Of course it would be to her anyway because everything is too big for her.
Yeah.
But it's so landlocked and that view of the ocean floor...
yeah,
with, you know, with used condoms.
Yeah, and garbage. Yeah, exactly.
You can't see the bottom because it's all garbage down there.
Yeah.
I just thought that was a really terrific juxtaposition to create because the thing you're constantly doing is that in a really fun way, you're sort of constantly pulling the rug out from under the characters here in a way that you really hadn't done before.
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, yeah, in one way we're pulling the rug out from under the characters. And another, what I'd like to see it as is in a sense... you know, to give each character their own reality and that you to give a convincing reality, a convincing interior life. And that I think that sometimes it, you know, because we all see each other differently and, you know, then it's, you know, experience things. We were experiencing something, but we both have our own, we come at it from such different places. And I think that that's something that's fun, especially in a TV show as a writer. That's so rare you can explore in movies, but you can in television because you can, yeah, just open windows into the interior world of a character, and suddenly it makes you see the other characters differently. And you know, it's been fun in Enlightened. We've had a couple standalone episodes where you get outside of Amy's head, and I think that those things, yeah, you know, hopefully it enriches the world and it makes you feel like you're more, you know, the emotional stakes become even more, you know, real, because you can see it from multiple sides, and that's fun as a writer to do.
I think that happens in so many things you've done. You know, you think about like Orange County, where what you do so often and have so much fun with is there's no judgment in the material. So we meet somebody and we think we know that person. I find myself asking these questions about the way people kind of either are alienated by Amy or fall in love with what she wants to do.
Yeah.
That's a really fascinating...
Well, it's definitely interesting from my perspective as somebody who just, you know, reads the, you know, reviews or reads people's comments about the show and her. Very early on, you know, they send out like a casting breakdown of like all the parts. It's a service that, you know, is provided to casting directors so that when people come in to audition, they have some sense of what the character, who the character is. And when Enlightened, the pilot, was first sent out, whoever was doing these casting breakdowns clearly thought like Amy was like a complete asinine like psychopath. And so like and I was just reading the way that this person, whoever it was describing her, and it was like the first time I was like, oh wow, like you know, the person that I see and the thing that I thought that I was, you know, putting out, I mean, I obviously knew that she, you know, would fly off the handle, you know, that she wasn't completely fixed and she was not enlightened, you know, completely. At the same time, I had a lot of sympathy for her, and I like the character, but it is funny how certain, you know, it's in a way it can, you know, be a Rorschach test into what people's attitudes about a certain kind of woman, a certain kind of do-gooder, a certain kind of, you know, like, I don't know, what their opinions are about. I love that as a writer. And it started with Chuck and Buck and, you know, like different protagonists, which is like even like Year of the Dog, which I thought the character was like completely sympathetic. But like I would get these reviews and you know, the character that Molly Shannon plays, people would say like she's like, you know, she's a terrorist and she's a whack job. And so like, you know, I'm used to that. And I do find it's interesting that, you know, that at this point, I feel like it's an affirmation that it's. That it's an interesting character, because, you know, if everyone has the same attitude about the character, then it feels it's maybe too simplistic or something, you know?
I think you're right. My guest who was last here for Year of the Dog is Mike White. His newest project with HBO is Enlightened. I guess what I like about the title, too, is like at a certain level, it's almost like Amy is kind of like a carrier of enlightenment. I mean, when she meets the reporter from the LA Times, she's got this whole thing in her head how it's going to be in the front page and it's going to be huge news. It's going to bring the company down. And he just looks at it and said, there's nothing here. Well, who do you have a grudge against anyway?
Yeah. I mean, and you see why she does have, I mean, she does have a grudge. I mean, and that part is real. At the same time, like, obviously this company is, you know, has bad crap going on. And so, you know, hopefully it's fun to be able to contain both readings. You know, it's like I always remark about this when I'm like in development meetings and at networks or studios or whatever, that like when you're young and you're in college or taking English classes or reading, you know, literature, you know, the whole idea of English classes are like taking a text and people having different, you know, readings on the text and talking about the, you know, the complexity of the text. But as you go into writing for movies and television, especially if you're getting hired to do it, everybody wants consensus on what the character is. They want consensus on how it's supposed to feel. You know, like there is this sense of like, you know, anything that feels like the ambiguity of that, it's like we don't want that. So it's like, you know, you spend your like life in school like trying to create this voice that is, you know, sufficiently complex or something. And then you get into Hollywood and you're like, oh, wait, this is not what's valued here. You know, this is not what they're looking for. And that part of it is frustrating. It's frustrating because you want to do, you know, you want to write interesting stuff. At the same time, you realize that it ends up somewhat marginalizing what you do.
We talked about this a little bit before you, when you were here last, before we were on the air, actually, for Year of the Dog, how that sort of sense of you find that you want to create subtext and all people want is text.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's kind of wonder what that's like for you. You talked about the development process. Was HBO on board with this pretty much immediately, or did you have to kind of bring them over to your side with this a little bit?
I mean, HBO is a very unique place, and as far as you know, they set the bar high for themselves. They want, you know, they want interesting, you know, dynamic work, and you know, clearly they have a good track record of putting out interesting, you know, shows. I do think that this show was still, in you know, still problematic in a sense for them, because I feel like, you know, I think that they did, you know, maybe similar to your experience of it, was that like I think they came into it with a certain set of assumptions that it was going to be slightly more of a satirical look at her, and it was a funnier look, and that as the show progresses and you know you get deeper into the characters, it becomes much more emotional. And I think that like that part of it was unexpected for them. And at the same time, for me, as I started writing, I felt like, well, this feels new to me. These kind of, you know, like a kind of clear-eyed, you know, like way of looking at a person who's, you know, has these sort of issues with delusion or whatever she's, you know, what are, and at the same time, like, you know, finding these moments where there's a lot of clarity and there, you know, and there's pathos. It felt like an exciting, you know, it's like, it feels like, you know, I don't know, there's a party that's like, you know, like a wine connoisseur or something, like, it's like, you know, after a while, like a certain taste, you want, like, you want, you know, a complex taste. Do you know what I mean?
I know, it's like
for me as a consumer of entertainment, that's what I enjoy, and it's something that I aspire to as far as what I make, and so some people are like, well, tonally, you know, that again, the tone is something that, you know, you'll find at studio, you know, this studio, you know, in networks, you, they want their comedies like outrageously funny.
Well, you've done network comedy, so you
I mean, and I think they know that I can do that. I mean, like a School of Rock, which is sort of more of a like a, I mean, I wouldn't say whatever. Down the middle, it's a clearly a comedy. It's not, you know, there's
but
not a lot.
But even School of Rock, there's still that kind of thing where we think he's one kind of person, and he really, I mean,
right? Yeah. Certainly, the protagonist fits into this, but as far as the tone, it's a little clearer, the tone of that movie. So it's like, for me, it's like, you know what I like about Enlightened, especially like as we get into the second season and I'm able to keep writing it. It's like I like being able to, I don't know, that the elasticity of the tone is what is inspiring to me and what's fun about it. And I feel like, you know, it's like I like the idea that the viewers, and this is probably why it's so ratings challenged, is that like that they don't necessarily know what to expect as far as how they're going to feel as they come to the show. You know what I mean? And to me, I like that. But it also is, it's difficult in the world of like, you know, selling your show.
Well, my guest who's trying to sell Cote d'Aron in a Pepsi world is Mike White. His newest project for HBO is a series, Enlightened. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Ever wish you could hear KCRW's signature music programming wherever and whenever you want? You can with Eclectic 24. Our ever-expanding all-music stream is available worldwide 24/7 online. You can listen to KCRW's diverse music mix on the go or in the car through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out. Go to kcrw.com/eclectic24.
Welcome back to The Treatment. My guest is Mike White, who's been away for way too long, and he's done many other things since Year of the Dog, but he's back to talk about his series Enlightened on HBO. I think what I really like about in this second season, especially with your character, for example, with Tyler, he feels one way about a coworker, and by the end of the episode, it's obvious he feels very differently about her, about the way they're basically sort of invading this coworker's privacy. But the woman played by Molly Shannon, by the way, and the kind of need that they... One of my favorite things you've ever done is the scene where he goes to her computer because he's going to share music files with her. And it's a really kind of heartbreaking scene because there are two things going on. And when he goes down to Amy and Dougie and finds that they've just basically jacked into her system, he doesn't really know where to look. And those two scenes back to back are really kind of wonderful.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I mean, it was... There's slightly, you know, there is this kind of monomaniacal storyline in this season, and I felt like it would be fun at the moment. You know, there's kind of this MacGuffin aspect too.
But,
but
in your things, there's kind of almost always a monomaniacal mission that somebody has.
Yeah, well,
there's someone who's
fun.
Kind of pointed towards magnetic north,
yes.
And other people don't quite believe it.
I can relate to a monomaniacal type of person, I guess. But I was going to say was that I just thought it'd be fun when the, you know, like at the moment where she like gets the MacGuffin, gets her like, you know, the proof of the malfeasance of the company, which is what she's been trying to get in sense for, you know, many, many episodes at this point, that we suddenly shift perspective and see it almost as like Amy almost becomes the villain in that plot. And it just felt like I was like, well, this feels like suddenly like it's, you know, now I don't know. I liked how it suddenly like changed your sympathies and made it, yeah, as suddenly as like Amy and Dougie are jumping up and down, you know, that they've, you know, Eureka, you know, have they've got what they want, that like suddenly you're like, oh no. They've got what they want.
But I see. I think in a situation like that, I mean, it's this thing where all basically boundaries of perception broken down. And to Tyler, they are villains because he's so excited about the idea of really sharing this music with her.
Uh-huh.
And when he goes downstairs, we expect. I mean, if it were a simpler, more clear cut thing, when he saw that Amy and Dougie, when this mission to sort of find this evil doing and then this chemical dumping, as a character, what do you think Tyler feels about this?
I mean, to me, Tyler is only there because, in a sense, he, you know, he's attached to Amy because he doesn't really have, you know, Amy has a vision, you know, in a sense, and Tyler has none, you know, as far as, like, life or, you know, he's a little bit, like, you know, he's scared, but it's like, and Amy's this, like, attractive blonde woman that, like, you know, obviously he'd had a crush on, and so he's kind of there because he's wants to please her, you know? And then suddenly he finds a, you know, actual somebody who wants to reciprocate, you know, his feelings. The plot of, you know, the whistleblowing has suddenly now outlasted its welcome. You know, it's like, you know, he doesn't want to, you know, he wants to, like, you know, he keeps saying, you know, and he's like, isn't there a way to have a happy ending for everyone here, you know? And it's like, you know, at this point you realize that there's just no way, you know?
And what I mentioned to you just as we sat down is I see the billboards in the poster. We can almost sort of like start putting X's
through the people
who aren't there anymore. Because I liked Omar.
Yeah, me too.
And this played by Jason Mantzoukas, by the way. It was really funny. And they're often somebody who's kind of an innocent.
Right.
And you're things, what's going on? They're kind of looking around bewildered.
Right.
And next thing you know, they're kind of shoved out of the picture.
Right.
And that guy is Omar here.
Yeah. Well, it was fun to sort of play with race and class in the sense in that episode because it's basically she sees herself, you know, she has this dream where she's like, you know, part of this Black Panther group that goes in and storms. You know, she sees herself as this like kind of like proletariat who's like aligned with all of the, you know, disenfranchised.
It's a real up the sandbox.
And then,
so
you know, then at some point it's like in the end what she accomplishes is basically the one person of color who works down in her thing gets the boot. And it's like, you know... And then at the same time, the reason he is targeted is because he was kind of like making fun of like the albino aspects of Tyler. So it's like, you know, I don't know. It just felt like it was a fun little, I don't know.
It was
kind of a revenge play.
It's very funny. And it also sort of, I think, is that the episode where she starts going on about looking around at people smiling? What are they smiling about here at this place where they work?
Yeah.
And you kind of go, you're out of your mind.
Well, it's to me, what was fun when you're writing it, you're like, this feels like Notes from the Underground, but like the suburban, like, you know, new age do-gooder version, you know, like it's like there's moments where she's like, it's almost like she's, yeah, like, you know, there's definitely voiceovers where you're like, she sounds like she's, yeah, she's like some Dostoevsky kind of like anarchist or something.
And the great thing about about Laura Dern's performance is that she always finds a way to smile at the strangest moments. I mean, which I'm not sure if it means if it's about completely this kind of belief that she's doing well or if she's also out to show a little bit of how she can't quite control her expression, so the smiles come out at the most inappropriate times.
Yeah. Well, I think what's funny about, to me, that part of it is also that in a weird way, she's still kind of a... there's a pleaser aspect to her. Like she, you know, even though she's such a subverter, and that is really just what Laura brings to it. But I like that she has this kind of face. She's not like a, you know, like a typical, like a radical feminist type of looking. You know, she wants to look pretty and she's this blonde, you know, like in you know, pretty dresses and amongst all of these. I just like the weird combination of her. Yeah, her sort of like pretty lady and also like this weird, you know, torture of the corporation.
But talk to me about meeting and getting Laura involved in this.
Well, Laura was involved from the beginning. Laura is a neighbor. She was in The Year of the Dog, and I've always been a huge fan, and, you know, I had always wanted to work with her. And, you know, HBO, she had done Recount for them and had won a Golden Globe or, you know, whatever. She'd done, you know, and they had a deal with her in place to find something for her. And, you know, I was like, I've always kind of wanted to work at HBO. I want to work with Laura. You know, she had ideas that, you know, were kind of in the vein of what I had been thinking about. And so we kind of like came together to do it.
Something she fits into here that often runs through your stuff, too, even something that feels like a down-the-middle comedy like School of Rock, this sort of dread of normalcy that these people have. I mean, they do – they're in a normal world. There's something about that they just don't like. Is that true? Really?
Well, at this point, I know I'm not normal. So I'm not – I don't dread normalcy. I mean, I feel like a lot of the things that I write are existential comedies in a sense. That sounds maybe pretentious. I don't know. But like it is about somebody looking for meaning, you know, for themselves and not wanting to be, I don't know, like going through the motions of life. And, you know, that's in The Good Girl. You know, I think all the characters are in some, you know, maybe not so much Chuck and Buck, but, I do think that, like, that's my experience of living is I'm, you know, a seeker to, like, find, you know, meaning in my life, you know. And so it's, I do think that, like, I tend to want to write about characters who are, you know, struggling with, I don't know, the banality of things. And they all come up with different prescriptions, but I can relate to that kind of.
But that kind of quotidian aspect of life goes from being like this thing that they're immersed in to something that becomes kind of a scary thing,
uh-huh.
Which I always find to be kind of fascinating about this stuff.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, it can get more, and you know, it's true in life. I think that, like, it can get, you know, desperate to. Especially, you know, it can be something where it's like, I need to find a reason to be, and I need to find a reason to, yeah, to, I think it comes, you know, for me, you know, I was the son of a minister, and his parents were missionaries, and, you know, it's like, there's a religious component to it, although for me, it's not religious, you know, but that feeling of, you know, having to, you know, have a bigger purpose. Yeah, it can ultimately be a very sort of a life or death kind of.
One of the things you must really love about getting to do this as a series is instead of having to compact it into a movie, we do get a chance to see how people can change over the course of a really intense experience.
Yeah. Well, I believe that people do change. I mean, that's kind of the thesis of the show. And I do think that that's, you know, I mean, obviously there are things that we, you know, neuroses we carry with us throughout our lives. But I also think that there's things that, you know, you do. I mean, that's life. I think that we become wiser with age, I think, or with pain, or, you know, that there's, and that part of it, I wanted to make sure didn't feel cynical. I do think that Amy is still always going to, you know, think of herself in these kind of grandiose terms, or she won't always be aware of everything that's happening. But at the same time, I feel like by the end, you see somebody who, by endeavoring to question these things, has made change all around her, you know, and all of these people are changed by what she's done. And, you know, it's not always for the positive, but it is, I don't know, it does feel meaningful in my estimation, I guess.
It's the treatment. My guest was clearly proselytizing right now is Mike White. His new adventure is Enlighten, the series on HBO. But I do think there's this thing that happens in your stuff, too, and we really get to feel a lot here in Enlighten, is people don't know what to do when it's quiet, when there's nothing going on around them. We see it a lot with Amy. She really doesn't know, even when her mother is there and bothering her, and you know, it's Laura Dern's mom playing her mom, which is really kind of fun to watch. But she doesn't know what to do, and that quiet becomes a really scary time in your pieces, doesn't it?
Well, that's, I mean, you know, it is called Enlightened, and it's, you know, there is a meditation aspect to her, you know, just she, you know, she, we see her meditating, and you know, the whole, and it is about, yeah, I think that is something that Amy really has a problem with is shutting up. I mean, and like, you know, it's anxious talking, and that's just, yeah, it's a character trait of hers. It's funny that the show, I think itself, is actually, for most shows on TV, it's actually kind of quiet. I mean, I read somewhere it was like, Enlightened, Jesus, that show that everyone's always whispering. And like, and it's true. For some reason, for me and I watching TV, I find that, like, I mean, I came from, you know, before I'd done this, the last show I did was a show that was like a quickly defunct sitcom for Fox. And I was, you know, you're so encouraged to like, it's like bing, bong, boom, you know, it's like everything is, you know, like the speed, the sounds, like everything is, it's very like, it's almost like a bombardment of colors and sounds and, you know, like, and for whatever reason, for me, I don't know, I can't watch something like that. It's hard. I mean, it's just difficult for me to, like, engage it because I feel like I've lost, like, I don't know. It's like if I don't have emotional through line to it and I don't feel like the pace I can get inside of it, I just disengage. So, you know, but, people feel like Enlightened actually moves slowly.
What I find so interesting about this, too, is that people are whispering, but there's that quiet, and sometimes the quiet means it's reflective, but often there's something kind of sinister just because Amy is just so, in her own way, ambitious that she just wants things to happen faster. And you kind of use that quiet and that inactivity. It's kind of almost like it's a character that's invading your space in some way.
Well, I think it's, you know, using that for me, it can work as tension. I like the idea of, you know, and this was something I was trying to do with Year of the Dog, and you know, I don't know if people like, you know, ultimately you can only, you know, answer to your own aesthetics, but I like the idea that you can create something where people can follow the story, but that it allows them to, I don't know, reverie about the other things while they're watching the movie. Or the show, like that there's enough space to have your own thoughts going on while you're engaging with what's happening. I know that sounds a little like abstract, but I do find that sometimes it's like, you know, a lot of movies are paced up so much that it's like, in order for you to like even know, you know, follow what's going on, you just have to like, you're riding a bucking bronco or something. And so, you know, for me, I feel like it's like this world is so, there is so much stimulus, and I feel like entertainment can also be something that can be reflective, and it can be, in a sense, meditative, and that could be something positive just because it feels like there's so many things that are going in a different kind of aesthetic direction. I mean, it sounds like I'm like ennobling my the pace of the show, but that's kind of the thinking behind it. You know, it's I like trying for that.
Oh, and this is where I got to say a word, everyone. I'm sorry. It's always great having you here, Mike. Thanks so much for doing this.
Elvis, you speak so eloquently about so many topics. Some people can only speak, I mean, like me, I can only speak eloquently about like a couple things, but you can just do it all.
And on that embarrassing note, I'm going to thank Mike White for being here. His series is Enlightened on HBO. Our recording engineer, who also mixes the show, is Melissa Morton. It's edited and produced by Jenny Radelet. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.